Welcome to Running Off the Rails. My name is Ariel Rasko.
And I'm Raymond O'Connor.
This week, we're going to do something a little bit different. We want to reflect on what the last year has meant for us on this podcast.
And then we'll talk about where Running Off the Rails is going.
So, Ray, how has this last year been for you?
This last year has been a total whirlwind. I don't think that I could have anticipated at all what this was going to be like when you and I were discussing even the possibility of making a podcast in the first place. I think you and I had had a few multi-hour conversations about Dungeons & Dragons and Critical Role and kind of the nuances of running Dungeons & Dragons. We both had watched the entire Matthew Colville Running the Game series, which I think just gave us so much fire to run Dungeons & Dragons. And the release rate of those episodes had slowed down, and I was feeling kind of this almost like this emptiness of, I feel like I'm stagnating in my thought about Dungeons & Dragons, and I want to continue to think analytically and critically about this hobby in the way that I'd run the game for my friends. And that's how it all started, and then from there, it really did just kind of run off the rails. We had this idea that we wanted to commit to one episode a week, no matter what, and other than that, there was a lot of things that we could experiment with, and oh my gosh, experiment we have. It's been a wild year.
I think for me, one of the most interesting parts about doing this weekly podcast with you is that I've really found it as a good way to engage with D&D on weeks where I didn't have a game with me and my friends. It let me simmer on some topics that I really didn't have time to explore before, and it's made my DMing so much better. I feel like I've had this really great opportunity to find a new and exciting ideas for the games that I was going to run. And so I've really changed the way I run travel based on what we talked about in the podcast. I've really changed the way I use magic items. I try to have a little bit more mystery and exploration with my magic items. I've really changed the way I run factions in the world. That was one of our most successful episodes, and it has also been one of the most successful things for me in my games. I now try to name things more often, and it really gets my players excited about something. And once they find a hook for one of these named factions, I start building out all the questions that we asked. What do they want? What are they doing? What could break them apart? How big are they? And it's really made my world feel more real. And I think that just that gift of, you know, improving on my games has really, you know, filled that gap that I was kind of looking for when, you know, I had watched a lot of these online series that, you know, you brought up, Ray.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely forced me to be more principled and deliberate in the games of Dungeons & Dragons that I run. Every week, having to think deeply about a different nuanced aspect of the game and trying to put to words the formula that makes that part of the game successful has forced me to be very deliberate about the way that I run. And now I notice when I'm doing things the way that I said that people should do things. And I also notice when I run into a situation where I'm like, oh, in this specific scenario, it makes more sense for me to go against the formula that I thought was correct and do something different instead. And thinking about Dungeons & Dragons and running Dungeons & Dragons as a set of choices to be made has been a very different way to think about the hobby. Instead of feeling like I am flying by the seat of my pants and trying to just keep the game running, especially for high-level players, I feel like I am more prepared to run the game, and that has been very fulfilling in and of itself.
Yeah, I think one of the things I wanted to impart was that running the game with intention, being really intentional about D&D, makes great role-playing and makes the hobby into more of like a passion. You know, for me, Dungeons & Dragons is the most fun thing that I do. Like, I have a few hobbies that I really put, you know, tons of hours and tons of myself into, and Dungeons and Dragons is one of my favorites because it's so social, it's so relationship-based. I'm doing this with my friends, and we become closer through this process. I really love Dungeons and Dragons, but I also have seen people go to the game and play in games that didn't give them that experience, and I wanted to maybe share what I was good at and the great experiences that other people have given me as well, other great DMs, you know, the experiences that they gave me, and I wanted to share that with other people so that they could really have these special moments with D&D, and I'm hoping that maybe in some ways running your game with more intention, you know, not necessarily planning for 6 hours every session, but just having in your mind in general these principles that we talk about a lot, you know, agency and consequences, railroading in the right way, putting stakes on the table in the right way. If you have these principles in mind, you don't need to prepare 6 hours for every session, but they can still be really fun, really realistic, and really meaningful for players.
Yeah, and maybe they can help you identify those warning signs, things that will be remembered as bummers ahead of time and deftly steer your group around them. I think like an example that comes to mind is a situation where you have a brand new player who wants to play Dungeons and Dragons. They know nothing about Dungeons and Dragons, and they say they want to play a wizard. And now all of a sudden you have someone showing up to the table who has not prepared at all. They don't really care about being able to cast the spells that a wizard is able to cast. They just wanted to be able to blast stuff with magic. You could have easily have made them a warlock or given them a ranger stat block, but changed their primary weapon to be magic. And that's something that we talk deeply about in the memory slots episode.
Yeah, I think that maybe the best piece of advice I've ever heard for D&D is to reskin a rogue or a ranger as a spellcaster for a first-time player of Dungeons & Dragons. If they want to be a wizard, if they want to do all these kinds of cool spells, you can literally just take a simpler class and make their attacks magical. Like, that's so brilliant, and I've used that since then, and it's made for great experiences at the table.
I think that was one of the driving motivations that caused us to make the podcast in the first place, if I'm remembering correctly. I think that I had been listening to a lot of sources that I really respect, like We Speak Common and the Running the Game videos from Matthew Colville, and I felt like there was this missing angle of advice and tools, which was, how can I present a brand new player? How can I manipulate the general rules of the game to give a brand new player a really positive experience? And I think that was kind of a general theme of our first couple episodes, was how do you do this concept that is well documented and lots of other people have given advice on, but for new players? And I felt that there was this information that was missing from the discourse. Definitely a piece of it was to test these ideas. Like, I feel strongly about these ideas and these philosophies. I hold them in my heart very dearly. I want to find out if there's merit to these ideas. Let's get it out there and see what people think. And it seems like it's been helpful. For the handful of people that have found our show, they stick around. So I'm just so thankful that was the case, and that people get enjoyment out of this thing that has been so beneficial just for me, like, and for us. But yeah, just really, really thankful.
Yeah, for sure. I think this idea of the resources available at the time for new players was, you know, really present in my mind too. We both talked about it a lot. If you kind of look back, I think this was before, you know, Critical Role did this YouTube series called Handbooker Helper. The reason that they created this series was because people they were introducing the show to, like their own friends and family, didn't know where to go to learn about the game. And I think the same idea of, you know, new GMs were getting lots of advice, but existing GMs running for new players, you know, that was the similar kind of you know, lack of space for new players to get resources. A great way to get a new person into the game is to have a GM that is good with new players. If your GM is running things like strictly as written all the time, I think that's actually a very unwelcoming game. I remember I was running D&D for coworkers, and this is something that I do a lot. And my games went really, really well. We had a ton of fun in all the sessions I did. I think I ran 9 sessions, you know, with 3 different groups of people that had never played before. One of my friends got really excited about this idea too, and he ran some games for his coworkers. And it didn't go as well. And so we kind of talked and spoke, and I gave him some advice. And I think, you know, in my head, I was thinking the same things, like, this person's been playing D&D for like 15 years. You know, why are they having trouble, you know, introducing the game to their coworkers? Oh, it's because playing as written, playing with, you know, a lot of the conventional advice isn't that friendly to new players. So I really liked that a lot of our first episodes, yeah, this is what we were thinking about. Like, what do you do to a new player who doesn't really know how to engage in the roleplay necessarily, or engage with their own character sheet necessarily? And focusing on that was, I think, a lot of fun. But then I think we realized that our audience in some ways was, you know, GMs who also like knew a lot about the game, and we could also just talk about really deep concepts. We didn't need to talk just about new player concepts. We could also talk about these really nuanced, more experienced DM tricks. I think that kind of was where eventually a lot of our episodes went towards.
Definitely, yeah. I think one of our most helpful episodes was our review of Arcadia 6, which was Spicing Up Factions. People seemed to really enjoy that episode. We got a lot of really positive feedback. I think that that episode unlocked kind of like a blueprint for further reviews. Like, we're not really interested in walking through the content, I think, of products and reading through paragraph by paragraph what's in it and saying whether or not we like it or don't like it.
Unlike Arcadia 1, where we literally read through the entire thing paragraph by paragraph. Like, you don't even need to buy that Arcadia. You can just listen to us and you'll get all the mechanical details.
Yeah, we had to, it was like 3 hours long. We had to split it into 2 parts because it was so long, and it was just like, oh, this isn't a good format.
Yeah. I actually love Arcadia 1 still to this day, but
I've used all of the content in that issue. But just getting back to the point before it flies away from my brain, this idea of picking apart supplements that are out there, because there's so many supplements, and kind of giving people an example of a way to read this content with an analytical lens of, oh, this faction article isn't just the Pickling Guild. What it actually is a template for me to make sure that I have created all of the things for my faction that's very different that I want to run in my game, and to make it feel real and fleshed out. I think that maybe a year ago, I would have read the Pickling Guild article and said, oh, this is a zany idea. It doesn't fit the tone of my game. What a shame. It seems like a really cool article. And I would have tossed it aside, perhaps. But now it's like looking at the core bones of supplements and being like, this is how you turn this article into a formula. That's been a really enjoyable process for me. I think it's really come through in my own homebrew that I've published, and it seems like other people really have gotten a kick out of it as well. So that was a really enjoyable experience to see people kind of like latch onto that episode.
Yeah, I think your point there that you wouldn't necessarily have looked at this supplement the same way a year ago really points to the fact that, you know, we've both grown a lot in the last year. I know, looking back on some of our older episodes, I think sometimes we give a lot of advice that is, you know, rule of cool. And then in other episodes, we'll give advice that's like, lean into the mechanics, put more mechanics into your game. You can build upon these things, and mechanics can be really important. And, you know, sometimes I look back and I wonder, did we change our minds about some things, or, you know, can we contain multitudes? You know, is there space for both of these ideas? And I do think in some sense, sometimes we have a little bit changed our minds, but obviously I think if you were to play D&D with either me or Ray, there would be so many moments where Rule of Cool was extremely important. There is room for both. We do contain multitudes, but I think there is also a little bit of growth and change in opinions for how to, you know, engage with mechanics in a really cool and meaningful way rather than to run away from them.
I think that's a really good point that we sometimes are hypocritical, and sometimes we call out our own hypocriticalness in an episode.
Yeah, definitely.
I think a great example of that is the putting player death back on the table episode, where I'm advocating so strongly for killing off player characters. As a player, I want nothing more than to feel like the DM is minutes away from killing my character. Like, nothing is more suspenseful, more dramatic, makes me more engaged in the game than feeling like my character's life is on the line. But then as a DM, in the campaign that I've run, I've found myself in a situation where I'm going to have a really hard time killing one of my player characters. They've taken their characters from level 2 to 12. They've experienced so much. It would be very difficult to have one of those characters die.
Yeah, I think maybe Mark on this podcast said that you are not allowed to kill his character.
Yeah. So Isotar. Yeah, I mean, he's just, that character has experienced so much, had multiple patrons, has sold his soul, has made like 3 different agreements, basically with his soul to 3 different conflicting patrons, and is trying to basically serve all of them all at the same time by taking their instructions at their letter instead of their meaning. And it's been so interesting to watch that unfold. Like, I would be really sad if his character died. It would be a true bummer. But to your point, or my point, or someone's point, I think it is possible to hold multitudes of opinions. I think that it is possible to say, in this scenario, given these circumstances, having this opinion and holding this position will increase the quality of your game. And I think more important than like deciding, oh, this way is the right way, doing it this way is the right way, is knowing what tools exist and being able to have the mental model or the mental visualization of being able to reach for those different tools and, yes, and use them deliberately.
Agree.
And knowing the pros and cons of taking a hard stance. And that is in contrast to kind of going with the flow as a DM. So the example here would be like, the difference between running the game off the rails and riding the game off the rails.
Yeah, I think this idea of having a toolkit, at any given moment, you aren't caught off guard. You can respond in a meaningful way, in a way that your players will really love and appreciate. I think that is, you know, the best way I would hope that our advice can be used. In any given moment, you know, you might even have conflicting advice from us. But you have this toolkit and you use that piece, you know, in this session, and then maybe 3 sessions later, you use a different piece. And I think this idea of containing multitudes is really makes sense when you think about it as a toolkit. A toolkit can have, you know, one tool that is useless in one scenario, but the most important tool and exactly what you needed in another scenario.
Yeah, I think that sums up what I hope our show has been. It's been so interesting. I mean, you talk about where we were in the way that we interacted with the hobby a year ago compared to where we are today. A year ago, I felt like I was like a pretty deliberate dungeon master, but was really just a consumer. And I had some fledgling ideas that I felt really strongly about, but it really felt like I was just complaining, not doing anything productive. Okay, well, what are you going to do about it? I can't just go on the internet and say I disagree, because that's not being additive. That's not being helpful. Instead of saying, oh, I disagree with XYZ, I should go out there and present an alternate option. And if people use it, that's great. And if not, I learned a lot by figuring out how to get audio onto the internet.
I mean, not just audio. You also, you know, you saw this problem of, you know, a spell casting, but also melee class that you didn't feel like there was, you know, exactly the right mix of that for you, and you just went out and created it. You created, there's one of 2 supplements that you made. You had This one was called The Weave Breaker, and I was so impressed because I always felt that making a character that could really use a sword and use magic should be so natural in D&D, but every time I tried to do it, I found like I was doing a lot of reading and a lot of work to get it to fit my own style.
That was such a huge learning experience. So just kind of talking about, yeah, like where we were a year ago. A year ago, I had never published anything before. The act of going out and learning how to use homebrewery to format a professional looking product, going out and buying stock art, like buying the licensing for stock art and finding it out there on the internet, like good art that I felt really represented what I was trying, the fantasy that I was trying to deliver with mechanics, and also just kind of being like, I think that this is good design, and putting my name on it and putting it out there and seeing what people would say. I mean, got a lot of positive feedback, people who are using the Pact of the Dragon God right now for their players, for their warlock classes. Mark switched his patron to be Tiamat and is playing a Pact of the Dragon God warlock. Has a pet dragon, not a part of the class, just that's a part of the supplement from Odyssey of the Dragon Lords. But then also a lot of critical feedback, like a lot of people forcing a conversation about like what is and what isn't broken in Dungeons and Dragons is a very interesting conundrum from like a designer side, that now because of the podcast we've had this unbelievable opportunity to talk to professional game designers, which has been just an amazing benefit of the podcast and such a wonderful experience, just kind of being able to empathize or sympathize with them, that it's like, yeah, game design is really hard, and no matter what, there's going to be a population of people who don't like or vehemently opposed to your ideas. Is definitely a weird thing to come to terms with.
You put in so much work into those. It's really cool the, you know, feedback you were able to get and the process of putting things out and then using them. I think that's really amazing. You've got some more coals in the fire coming up. Something that I helped on that, you know, Ray has really been the architect of, which is really amazing. So, you know, keep an eye out for that coming in the new year. Hopefully more things. We want to be making more. And, you know, I had some stuff going on in my personal life this year, but one of my goals for the next year is to, you know, follow in Ray's footsteps and publish my own things. And, you know, I think in order to do that, going forward, the podcast might look a little different. So do you want to talk about, Ray, kind of what our shifting priorities are?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, this podcast has opened up so many possibilities for us. It really has been an unbelievable experience, and I'm so thankful to anybody who's listening, anybody who has listened, maybe fell off along the way, or anybody who's, maybe this is your first episode. As a result of this podcast, we've been receiving professional offers to engage in professional products for game design. And that is absolutely something that we want to pursue. But both Ariel and I also work full-time jobs and produce this podcast. So going forward for this next year, at least, we will not be publishing once a week. We'll be publishing once every other week. The idea is, or the commitment is, during that time that we're stealing back for ourselves, we will be writing or producing layout or gathering art and sources and producing products for people to consume at like basically at for cost value, at least the products that we have control over. Cause I mean, really it is for us, it's testing ourselves and building a portfolio of design. If we were trying to do this for profit, we would quit our jobs and do it full time. It's more so to pursue improvement in this hobby, which is so deep and has so many possibilities. And I mean, I could have never dreamed that this would have been a possibility thinking back to a year ago when we first started making this podcast. And I just can't even imagine what the possibilities will look like at the end of next year. If it turns out that people like what we're doing, maybe, I don't know. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, I think from both our perspectives, I like my job. I really do like my current job, but it's one of those things where, you know, if you look 10 years, 15 years, 20 years in the future, I don't see myself in that same role. And I think you've kind of felt the same way, Ray. Is that right? That you're looking for something that you can move into that is more fulfilling for you. And I think for both of us, this is something we're exploring. We want to take back this time, spend a little bit less time recording, and do a little bit more publishing and imagining and creating, and see if that's something that we can turn into some kind of project, you know, going forward for our lives. That's definitely how I felt. I know that you're really on this idea, Ray, of making this something that you can, you know, transition into long term.
Absolutely. I mean, my short-term dream is to write for Arcadia, which is MCDM's magazine, and has been one of the driving motivations behind publishing to the DMs Guild. They've been very clear about what you need to do in order to become a writer for that magazine. You need to publish and you need to get your name out there so that they basically hear about you instead of you reaching out to them and being like, I want to write for your magazine. So that's a good short-term goal, I think. And then the long-term goal is, yeah, I don't really see myself doing my current career maybe 10 or 15 years from now. And it'll either be professional game design, or I'll probably be a high school teacher and track coach and hopefully be doing game design either on the side or professionally. And maybe being the track coach will be my part-time job. My fiance is a teacher, and I think that's a really fulfilling job, and I would love to do that someday.
Yeah, I don't know like exactly what my plan A's, B's, and C's are. There's always a little piece of me that's like, what if I, you know, retire to Montana early and buy a place and just ski all the time and go like hiking in Glacier Park? And I feel like there's a 25% chance that just happens at some point. I don't know if that's plan A or plan D. I'm not really quite sure. You know, I think there are a lot of things this year that have really inspired us and really shown us that you actually can take something and make it your own. And for me, one of these moments that I had where I saw something like this was I'd run a homebrewed one-shot a couple times. And one of the ideas I had for this one-shot was that, you know, there was going to be this town hall where you had to try to convince the town to get on your side, something that I felt D&D doesn't have exactly the right way to do. I feel like you spend so much time in like large cities or small villages, but you only interact with like one person and you don't get to really engage in the local politics. And we talk about politics a lot, and lots of other people talk about politics in your game design a lot. And I wanted my players to be able to just like go to a town hall or go to a city council meeting. And the way I ended up doing this, I figured out a way where instead of me playing 100 NPCs at once, I gave everybody at the table a role card, and they had a little description of what their town's member cared about and what they would bring up in the conversation at this town hall meeting. And then one of the players would be a representative of the party. And this kind of makes sense. If you have a group of five adventurers, not all five of them are going to speak at a town hall. You know, you'd have somebody who is a representative for your interests. And this actually worked amazingly well. Everyone was really, really excited to change their character for a moment. They didn't know exactly how they were going to roleplay. They had to stop and consider a new narrative for themselves. And it was this really fun moment. And then I saw this exact same scenario play out in an episode of Exandria Unlimited. I won't include any spoilers, but there is one episode where the players at the table get the chance to play out members of a local town. Abria Iyengar, the DM, hands out role cards just the way I did, and they get to discover a new character in the moment at the table, and it's surprising and exciting and weird, and it was really successful. And, you know, just looking at that and seeing that, I felt, okay, this is something that I want to double down on and write up in, you know, a more meaningful way and show myself that my ideas are interesting and exciting. And so I took a lot of inspiration from, you know, seeing somebody do something like that out in the real world. And I think my goal for the next year with this time that we're taking for ourselves is to be more bold, be more audacious, and try to really create something like that.
Yeah, I really like this idea. I think it's a good tool when the time is right. The idea of, hey, pause on your character for a second. We're going to go and play some other stat blocks for a little bit. I've been going through and re-listening to Matthew Colville's Running the Game playlist, as I do on a semi-annual basis now. And one suggestion he gives for when your party is about to TPK is you can hit the pause button and say, we're going to stop here for now. And then when the players show up to play again the next week, instead of picking up the combat where you left off on that cliffhanger where it looked like certain doom, the players are given new adventurer sheets. And the players play as those wacky, zany adventurers for the other half of the dungeon, the half of the dungeon that the players didn't encounter before they got to the boss. And then that party of adventurers show up as the party is about to lose in that moment where the DM paused the game. And now instead of being down two player characters and almost certainly facing total party knockout, now all of a sudden the party is up for new adventurers. And I think this is a good way to kick off an adventure too. I think there's a classic adventure, either the Rise of Vecna or the Rod of Many Parts or Seven Parts, Nine Parts. I'd have to look it up. Where you start off as playing the Circle of Eight and then Vecna kills all of the Circle of Eight. And that's how the adventure kicks off, losing to the big bad evil guy, playing as very powerful stat blocks. I think it's a great way to give your players an alternate perspective without putting their characters necessarily directly in the line of consequence. So you can give your players consequence and foreshadow consequence without forcing your players to lose their beloved player characters. So I really like this idea.
Oh yeah, I actually do remember that adventure. It's maybe the Return of Vecna, or maybe it is one of the two you mentioned. I'm not sure, but it's such a freaking cool and memorable opening. Reading that adventure definitely opened my mind to like, oh, your table, your D&D adventure can be crazy and multifaceted and exciting. It is such a cool way to start an adventure. You kind of go back through our episodes sometimes or through these MCDM videos. Was there one thing looking back that was like, oh, this was really inspiring for your year of, you know, running D&D and thinking about D&D?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many interesting things. Like one small thing that comes to mind is, oh, hit dice are an interesting resource that you can have players spend for like powers or abilities, or you can work it into a class. And the Weavebreaker, the class that I designed, uses hit dice as a core part of its design. But probably the most transformative influence that I experienced this last year was I got to see the action-oriented design video from Matthew Colville. And oh my God, that just blew my mind and has stuck with me for all of my design ever since. This idea that you can take a monster stat block and really just steep it in its narrative. So not even just the mechanic of this like villainous actions for action-oriented monsters. The idea that you can design additional features for monsters that are very, very strongly connected to how the monster looks, like the things that are on the monster that are significant and look really cool, and that are really, really core to the narrative. It's changed the way that I evaluate monster stat blocks when I'm reading them. I think an example that comes to mind is for a supplement we're working on, we were looking at giant stat blocks. And something that really stuck out to me was that giant stat blocks in 5th edition are really kind of devoid of thematics. I think each of them has maybe a feature that kind of flavors things a little bit with like the type of giant that you're dealing with. But for the most part, when you read the lore that is available for the giant stat block, for example, fire giants are these kind of feudal giants that have their own kingdoms and kind of like feudal hierarchies, and they're very martial and they have armor and swords and they're kind of like smiths. They're almost like they almost have this like samurai medieval Europe kind of like culture to them. And then you look at the stat block and that doesn't come across at all. So this idea that when you're going to run a monster for your players, take a look at the stat block that is provided. And if that stat block doesn't tell the story, the narrative story that you want your players to experience, add abilities to that sucker. Give that fire giant a fire sword ability where if they don't have a weapon in their hand, they can materialize this magical flaming blade. Like something that just screams evocativeness. Yes, this fire giant is a fire giant. It's not just some giant that like has the colors of a fire giant and is resistant to fire damage. Like it does fire stuff. You will remember this fire giant as being a fire giant and connect their culture to their abilities too. Like give them a parry ability that shows how skilled they are with their weaponry. Yeah, it really opened my eyes that the stat blocks that are presented by Wizards of the Coast or any of the people who design monster stat blocks is not the stat block you have to put in front of your players. Like, change it. Especially if your players are experienced. Like, give them something totally wacky to deal with. My players are about to have Orcus in an encounter that they're in. I created this, like, 1,000 or 2,000 foot battle map that I'm going to run in Roll20, and Orcus is on one side of the battle map and they have an objective on the other side, and we'll see what happens. They might kite him. He may decide not to interact with them, but either way, he's on the battle map, so I need a stat block for him. I was looking at the Orcus stat block that is presented in the back of the Out of the Abyss book, and it just didn't speak to me. One of his primary actions is to use like a tail attack. And when I think of Orcus, the demon prince of undeath and rage, I do not want a single turn of my combat to be Orcus uses his tail attack. So I'm using something totally different. And I think that video, for some reason, was like the thing that said to me, you have permission to go and change all this stuff. Like, you don't need to run it as written. You can be critical of the official design and come up with something that you think will be more fun for your players.
Yeah, I think this idea of being additive is really something that I've internalized a lot when I'm designing things and when I'm running my games. This idea that you can be additive in ways that do not complicate your players, they do not confuse your players or add too many like memory slots for them to use, too many things for them to do and remember at the table. So I really love this idea of adding a stronghold to your villain, giving your villain a specific place where they are holed up and they go back there to regenerate their stats, and they get a domain action because of this, and they get these really magical legendary things that they can do when the players show up to their domain for the first time. This is really additive in that you could have a normal orc, and then you could have a legendary orc prince. And this orc prince has these strongholds and domain actions, and they affect the players, but they don't make the players have to keep track of anything. Something happens to the players that makes them think, wow, this villain is special. This villain is different. They may look like something from the monster manual. They may look like something from the player's handbook even, but they're not the same as this thing that I'm familiar with. You get permission to change and add to the existing design. And I think this idea that you're talking about of getting permission to be bold and change things in exciting, meaningful ways is really internal to all the things that we're trying to do here and what a lot of these great homebrewers and designers who have turned their own homebrew into professional work. Like, this is what we're doing. And I've found it so inspiring. I think MCDM's take on villains and monsters has been hugely inspirational to the two of us for, you know, what you can do to the pre-written material.
Yeah, I'm really excited for this next year. We still don't intend to ask our listeners for money or patron donations, because it's not really what we want to do. But if you've been listening for the last year, or you're a new listener and you like what we're doing here, the best way that you can thank us is really just give our podcast to one of your friends and ask them to give it a listen and see if they think it'll be helpful. If each of our listeners could just grow our listenership by one, it would make an amazing difference. And we're really just interested in reaching as many people as it is helpful for us to reach. And it's really hard to do these days. So passing us along would make a really big difference. And I hope that you stick with us for the next year. And
we're going to do our best to make it meaningful and to really create more things and bring more things to the table.
And I hope that everybody has a happy holiday and a peaceful holiday. And we'll see you again after the new year. Until next time, I'm Raymond O'Connor.
And I'm Ariel Rasko.
And thanks for listening to Running Off the Rails. If you enjoyed Running Off the Rails, please like, follow, and review our show on your platform of choice. Please follow our Instagram, Running Off the Rails, for notifications whenever we release a blog post, a new episode, or new content on the DMs Guild. If you prefer a specific type of content, please send us a message on Instagram. The jam you are listening to is Hoist by Andy G. Cohen, and you can find Hoist and more of Cohen's music on the Free Music Archive. You can find links to all of our content at runningofftherails.com or on our Facebook page, Running Off the Rails.